ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
How do you run a commuter rail transport network, organising heavy and fast-moving trains carrying thousands of people many times an hour across hundreds of kilometres? What could possibly go wrong? How do you keep them safe and reliable and comfortable, on time, and keep everyone happy? I imagine it is a job that is the epitome of the word B-I-G. Joining us tonight are two people who know just how big. Catherine Rinaldi is president of the MTA Metro North Railroad, and it runs customers through New York and Connecticut via the Hudson, Harlem and New Haven lines. And she runs trains into Grand Central Station in Manhattan as well. Catherine, President Rinaldi, good evening to you.
Hello, Phil. It's great to be with you tonight.
Great to be with you too as well. Also joining us tonight, Kylie Gorham. Kylie's Senior Product Manager of Smart Transport at NEC Australia. Kylie, good evening to you as well.
Good evening, Philip, and good morning, President Rinaldi.
Yes, terrific. Well, terrific to have both of you here with what worrisome jobs. Do you ever go to bed, Catherine, thinking I'll get woken up inside the hour because something's bound to have gone wrong?
Well, there have been many nights that I've gotten woken up in the middle of the night. So I keep my phone very close to my bed, and I have gotten those calls in the middle of the night and had to get up and get someplace where there's been a problem. So, yeah, it's part of the job. Comes with the territory.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Tell us about the size and scope of the MTA Metro North Railroad. What's involved here?
Sure. So Metro North Railroad serves the suburbs north of New York City. We cover, unfortunately, I'm going to give you miles and not kilometers. So
yeah,
we cover
okay.
about 2,700 square miles of territory. So and we also go into the state of Connecticut. So it's a pretty large operation. We had in 2023, our annual ridership was a little bit over 60 million. We're the railroad that kind of drives the northern suburbs. And for a time, though not anymore, I was also the interim president of the Long Island Railroad at the same time as I was running Metro North. And that's the commuter railroad that serves the suburbs of Long Island, which is to the east of New York City. So together, that commuter rail network is, you know, a really important part of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which is kind of the umbrella organization for public transport in the New York City metropolitan area. The MTA, as it's called, also includes the subways and the buses, in addition to commuter rails and some bridges as well.
Mm. See, without you, the city doesn't work, does it? Because you're pouring people into the city and back out to the city to their homes every single day.
Yeah, no question. I mean, I think New York is one of those cities that really, really relies upon transportation, public transportation, to make the city what it is. So my boss, who's the chairman of the MTA, says that, you know, public transportation is like air and water for New York. New York would not be New York without the public transportation network that we're all blessed with. But to your point a little while ago, you know, sometimes things go wrong, and it's I've got a team of amazing professionals that keep things going.
Mm. See, because I'm thinking most of these rail, I mean, correct me, please, but I'm thinking there must be huge infrastructure challenges because most of these railways were built in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in the golden age of the expansion of rail from the, well, I suppose, the 1850s and 60s onwards, but particularly around the turn of the century. They're 100 years old, more, aren't they? How adequate are they these days?
Well, I mean, that's absolutely true. So, you know, at least here in the U.S., I mean, these rails were originally owned by private companies, but, you know, they couldn't make a go of it. So in the 1960s, they became part of this public authority that ran them. The MTA, you know, assumed responsibility for this network. Needed to sink a fair amount of money, to your point, to be able to restore the infrastructure because, you know, our prime objective is to, you know, get people to where they need to go safely. And you need to have a safe infrastructure to be able to do that. So, you know, a good example of the kind of things that we're talking about is for people who may or may not know the Metro North system, the trains converge just north of Manhattan and they traverse a viaduct over over Park Avenue mm-hmm. and eventually go into a tunnel into Grand Central. So that Park Avenue viaduct was built in the late 1800s. And, you know, it's safe, but it's old. I mean, we've been monitoring its condition for years now. And we had a very, very serious fire under that viaduct. There was actually a garden center where some mulch went up in flames and really damaged the viaduct. And that really focused our attention on replacing it entirely. So you've got this massive steel viaduct that's been there for over 100 years that we're having to replace piece by piece in order to be able to keep the the trains running, right? Because, I mean, every single train...
Because you can't stop it. You can't just say, oh, we're going to stop and pull down the viaduct and rebuild it, because that's going to take a year or more.
Well, exactly. It's going to take multiple years to be able to do that. It's going to cost billions of dollars. And you need to continue to run train service, because that's, you know, that's the heart of the Metro North network, is beautiful and historic Grand Central Terminal, right? So you can't stop running trains into Grand Central. So we need to figure out how to continue to run the trains while giving the folks who are actually replacing the viaduct the time and the space that they need to be able to do so safely and, frankly, as quickly as possible to be able to minimize the disruption to customers. So that's, you know, just one infrastructure challenge. And there's other infrastructure projects really throughout the network. Grand Central itself. Grand Central itself opened in 1913. there used to be, you know, the train yards where the trains, you know, come out of used to be open air. But, you know, New York, of course, grew around Grand Central. So, you know, there's actually a steel structure that encases those train yards. And New York City, Park Avenue is built above that. But they, you know, it's not watertight, right? So you've got water leaking into the system. This train shed, as we call it, is starting to rust. And we have to actually replace the train shed that is covering the tracks that make up the Grand Central Complex. You know, another major, massive infrastructure project that's being undertaken now to be able to keep the system running.
As president, Catherine, does the buck stop on your desk?
It does, yeah. I mean, I've got an amazing team and, you know, I have experts who are experts on infrastructure, experts on scheduling, experts on the, you know, dealing with, you know, a perturbed condition if we have some sort of a, you know, operational incident. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the decision making with respect to the railroad, you know, I'm the buck stops with me, as you say, yes.
Yeah, because I sometimes think of railways and think, well, look, they were huge infrastructure, a bit like city sewage systems, you know, which were put down at the time with a hope that they would be adequate. But of course, as cities grew around them, pulling them up and replacing them has become like a monumentally expensive and almost impractical thing to do. But the number of trains running on these lines when they were put down has probably increased tenfold, hasn't it?
Well, I mean, we're running, you know, if you look back to where we were prior to the pandemic, we're running, you know, essentially the same level of service as we were then. So we run 746 revenue trains every weekday, 683 into Grand Central, and then we also have a smaller operation west of the Hudson River. So, I mean, it's a fair volume, and you know, especially in the morning and the PM peaks, you know, there's a lot of service running into and out of Grand Central. But I think your point is a good one. You have to balance the need to provide that regular, reliable service with the need to tend to the infrastructure and make sure that you're doing the work necessary to keep the system safe. And there's that balance that we deal with every single day.
We're talking with President Catherine Rinaldi of the MTA Metro North Railroad in the USA. These railroads or railway systems, of course, are common all over the world, like the big ones in London, the big ones in parts of New South Wales, particularly Sydney, of course. Melbourne's rail network is very big as well. So these problems are common. So if you'd like to ask a question, 1-300-800-222 is the number. Kylie Gorham's with Smart Transport at NEC. Kylie, tell me about what you do and how you make rail transport easier.
Great questions, Philip. Thank you. Smart Transport Solutions is really the core of what we do. President Catherine Rinaldi is looking after the day-to-day operation of the rail network under her care, and organisations like mine provide solutions that enable them to do that as effectively as they can, give them great opportunities to be proactive about things that are happening in their network that they might need to address, and look for opportunities to always be improving their operation. In Australia, as you say, yes, we definitely have some very large rail networks in places like Sydney and Melbourne. But we also have a really large bus network in terms of public transportation across the nation. And most people in Australia, you know, they've caught a bus, hopefully. I hope they've caught a bus recently. And in recent years, they've probably used a smart card or a mobile phone when they've paid to board a bus or a train. And when they've been at a bus station, they've looked up to a sign and they've seen information that's told them when the next service is arriving so that they can plan their travel, or they're standing at a bus stop and they're looking at that information on a mobile phone. So solutions like that are ones that we're also always delivering out to improve the customer experience when they're using public transportation. There's two really large parts to the smart part of what we do for transportation. One of them is making sure that the operators of those public transportation services are really enabled with solutions and technologies that assist them in their role. And on the other side, we really look to make sure that the customer experience that passengers have is optimal and gives them the opportunity to choose public transportation first when they're making decisions about how they go from one place to another.
1-300-800-222 is the number if you would like to ask a question. We've got a couple of women with us tonight who know about rail and transport systems. Catherine Rinaldi is president of the MTA North Railroad in the United States. Kylie Gorham's the senior manager with the Smart Transport at NEC. Lines are free and you get through. Carl from Eltham. G'day, Carl.
G'day, how are you going? I'm a follower of high-speed rail and have made suggestions about high-speed rail in Australia.
Oh, yeah.
But the one that's always confused me is, why is it taking the United States so long to provide super high-speed rails? Why is it countries like Italy and Germany, Spain, that have 300-kilometre-per-hour trains, and the US hasn't made that step?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Catherine, that's a point, actually, isn't it? The high-speed rail is a feature in Japan and Europe, and anyone who's ridden on in France knows that too. It's not so much a feature of the US system. Why is that, do you think?
So I think a couple reasons. I think, you know, at least with respect to the northeastern part of the United States, which is where I am, it goes back to your earlier point with respect to the aging infrastructure. So, you know, the condition of the track, you know, the shape and the way that the track kind of runs and the curves and that sort of thing have made it challenging to be able to increase speeds. That's actually one of the initiatives that I'm working on together with Amtrak, which is the regional rail carrier in the U.S., is to improve speeds along the Northeast Corridor, which is a major segment of the national rail network. But, you know, there's been new infrastructure funding made available in the U.S., and there's a number of high-speed projects underway now. There's one that they're looking to construct in Texas, also in California. So there is some movement towards a high-speed rail network. I think the constraints have been the existing infrastructure and also just the sheer amount of capital that it takes.
They're stupendously expensive. They're stupendously expensive, aren't they?
Well, and I also think the size of the U.S. has proven a challenge, right? I mean, I think that, you know, a country like Italy is much smaller, so rail is attractive as a way to get around. I think, you know, when you're talking about getting around the U.S., and I expect Australia is the same way, a lot of people opt to fly as opposed to taking the trains, because the trains can be rather expensive. So that's been a challenge as well.
Yep, indeed. I think that's probably right, Carl. It's cost and infrastructure. But we've got the same problems in Australia, haven't we? If we want to build a high-speed rail line here, we have to build a whole new rail line. And, you know, given our distances, it's massively expensive.
Well, the thing is that if you were doing it in Australia, what you would be doing with super high-speed rail to regional centres to help with population decentralisation. And the costs are high, but they're not prohibitive. They're not more than something like the ring rail that we're doing in Victoria. And yet we have, for reasons which are utterly beyond an observer like me, we've decided not to put high-speed rail into Geelong.
Yeah.
And the logic defies me, if there is any.
Yeah, well, no, I take your point. And as you know, here on the program, we've long been a supporter of developing some high-speed rail, particularly the Melbourne-Geelong link, particularly the Newcastle-Central Coast to Sydney link as well. And there are also opportunities in the Gold Coast. But thanks, Carl. Good on you. 1-300-800-222. Here's a point, Catherine, isn't it? The trouble with the railway line, or not the trouble with, the fact of a railway line, is it's not infinitely expandable, is it? I mean, are you running as many trains now as you could on the line, or could you run more?
We are basically maxed out. And I think part of the reason why we're maxed out is just the capacity in and out of Grand Central, right? I mean, I think that in the morning, it's literally one train after the other going over that viaduct. The other thing that kind of complicates that dance a little bit is kind of a somewhat unique attribute of the Metro North system is that we have a lot of people who actually commute in the opposite direction. So I don't know if in Australia we call it a reverse commute, right? So we have people who have jobs outside in our territory who want to get on northbound trains. And that complicates how many trains we're able to run in those peak hours. You know, people wanting to go outbound in the morning and inbound in the evening. So kind of managing that whole aspect of the network. It's a great problem to have, but it also, you know, is a bit of a constraint with respect to our ability to add more inbound service. Mm.
John from Cavity Valley wants me to ask you, he said, can you ask about the, I'm only asking this question, Catherine, because I've got no idea what he's talking about. Can you ask about the Guastavino structural tile work in Grand Central and how much maintenance it requires? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. So Grand Central is an absolutely beautiful, stunning building.
It's a stunning, it is.
It had its 100th anniversary a few years back. And I have an entire team of people who that's their job is to take care of Grand Central. And they do it, you know, lovingly and with great care. So I have carpenters and I have people who weld and I have people who, you know about all the different structural challenges and plug up the leaks and everything else. So I have a dedicated staff of people in my maintenance of way department who take care of that building like it's their own house. And, you know, that's like one of the joys of my job, frankly, is being the steward of Grand Central Terminal, because it's this beautiful, iconic building that is so central to the New York experience. And, you know, so many people, you know, we see Australians in there every day, you know, foreign tourists make that a major stop when they come to New York. So, you know, we're super proud of the building and super proud to be stewards of that building.
Mm. Yeah, I'm sure you are. Kylie, given Catherine's point that you can't put any more trains on the system, how do you make it better for people? What are you looking at?
Well, Catherine has pointed out an absolute reality about the cost and impact of rail infrastructure. It's expensive to invest in. It's very disruptive to install. And by contrast, bus networks are far easier to implement in communities and make available to people at a much lower cost and a far greater immediate benefit to people without the impact. One of the reasons we have such an expansive bus network in Australia is some of those benefits. And I think that if we're looking for opportunities to improve public transportation in Australia, finding ways to get more out of the bus networks that we have, the bus fleet and the services that they offer is one of the ways that we can basically have more seats available for people to take trips each day.
Mm, that's true, although buses require roads. And here we go again.
Yes, definitely they do require roads. And it is a question we have to ask ourselves as we see some of the trends in the way that people are choosing mobility in our environment today in Australia. Should we be prioritising buses and other forms of transportation over private vehicles, making them the first class choice?
Mm. Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. What's cheaper, actually, Catherine? What's cheaper to run? Is it cheaper to move people by rail, or is it cheaper to move people by road on a unit cost, as it were?
Well, I that's an excellent question. I mean, we sink a lot of money into our highways here, but I think from an environmental perspective, I think rail is way, way more efficient. I mean, you're carrying a lot more people. So from a protecting the climate perspective, you know, that's part of the story that we tell about rail and subway here, is that it's a much more environmentally friendly way of traveling than the road system is.
Mm. Brian from St. James. G'day, Brian.
Yeah, how are you going, Phil? And hello to the guests tonight. I wanted to ask Kathy, was the original construction of the underground there, or was it prudence or was it foresight? In other words, shifting a large number of people in a large city, was it foresight to put it underground, or was it just there was no room? Given the fact that rail does take up a bit of room on the thing if it is put in.
Yeah. No, it's a good question, Catherine. Yes. Well, how much was planned and how much just happened?
Well, I think that's actually a really interesting question. The one thing that I would say, though, is that at least the U.S., the New York subway system originally was a bit of both, right? Mm. It was underground, but there were also elevated lines throughout the city. And most of those elevated lines ultimately came down. Mm. I think it was a tremendous amount of foresight. But I think it was foresight plus necessity, right? I mean, I think, even back when the subways were first being constructed, there was, New York is a tremendously bustling city. And I do think that there was, thinking that we needed to be able to continue to have the activity above ground by putting the mode of transportation underground. And I think, we've really benefited from that, right? I mean, I think that the subway in New York, as I said, I don't run the subway system, but the subway in New York is the great equalizer. I mean, everybody takes the subway here.
Yeah, yeah.
People, for whatever reason you need to travel in the city of New York, whether it's work or a doctor's appointment or to see your friends, rich or poor, whatever you are, wherever you live, it's the great equalizer in New York. And it really is the thing that makes the urban core possible here, because you could not possibly have that many cars on the road. People don't own cars here. People don't even learn how to drive here. You really need the subway to get where you want to go.
I love that, the great equalizer, because it's true of New York, isn't it? It's also, I mean, it's true of London too, and I don't know Tokyo, but I presume that it's true in Tokyo as well, because that's right, there's no other reasonable way, actually, of getting around the city. So rich or poor, high or low, except maybe if you're Donald Trump, you have to get around on the subway. Look, let's welcome some other people to the program. My guest, Catherine Rinaldi, who is president of the MTA Metro North Railroad in the US, and Kylie Gorham from NEC. Let's welcome some others to the show.
This is Nightlife with Phil Clark
on ABC Radio.
We're talking to the smart people who run commuter rail transport networks tonight. President Catherine Rinaldi is the president of the MTA Metro North Railroad in New York. Runs trains to and from the northern suburbs of New York into Grand Central and elsewhere. And I think, how many people did you move last year, Catherine? 60 million people, was that it?
We moved, a little bit over 60 million people.
Okay, so just a tiny number. Kylie Gorham from NEC is with us too. She works with Smart Transport, who are trying to figure out all sorts of ways to move people around in a smarter and more convenient way. Kylie, the thing, because if you asked a person, what do you want out of public transport? I think most people would say, I don't want to think about it. I just want to walk out onto the street, or I want to walk to a train station which is nearby, close, and go to a platform or a bus stop and get on something, within a few minutes. I mean, I don't want to worry about timetables and I don't want to worry about tickets. Would that be it?
Absolutely. You've been talking to some people, Philip. I like to use the word frictionless. One of the objectives we have is to encourage people to choose public transportation first by making it as frictionless as possible. The types of things that will deter a person from catching public transportation over choosing, for example, their private vehicle include a lack of consistency in the timing of public transportation services. An inability to stay on schedule creates a loss in confidence from the travelling public on public transportation. If you have to make a decision, I need to go somewhere and it will take me 20 minutes if I drive in my private vehicle. But alternatively, I could walk 5 minutes down to the local light rail network and I could take a 15-minute ride on the light rail and another 5 minutes on the other side. Now, it might take me an extra 5 or 10 minutes for that journey if I'm going to take it on the public transportation instead of in my private vehicle. It seems like a good value proposition to choose public transportation. The problem occurs when the service is late. And so that slightly longer journey, 5 or 10 minutes, could become 15 or 20 minutes because they've got to wait for a service that's late arriving. And that just makes their whole journey larger in time and more inconvenient. And so they choose their private vehicle. So reliability is one of the biggest factors to ensuring that people choose public transportation first. More reliable, more passengers.
Mm. Generally, Catherine, train systems are... Look, assuming you don't have massive breakdowns or you don't, you know, you lose electricity or something, they are reliable almost inherently, aren't they? Because there's nothing else on the track other than the train. Why can't it arrive on time?
Yeah, no, they are. I mean, we're actually very proud of our on-time performance. Our on-time performance over the course of the last year has been, you know, very strong, you know, 98%, 99%. So we're very proud of that. And I could not agree with Kylie more. I do think that the reliability of the service, but also I think the frequency of the service is important. I think that, you know, back in the pandemic, we were running service maybe every half hour, every hour. And, you know, if you miss a train, you have to wait another hour for another train. People aren't going to do that. So people want reliable service, but they also want, you know, frequency of service that meets their travel needs. And I also completely agree with what Kylie has been saying in terms of information about your trip. I think people very much want to be able to plan their trip and understand what they're in for when they walk out of their door in the morning. So we do have signs on our platforms, you know, indicating when the next train is coming. And we have, you know, timely announcements if the trains are delayed. We have a really excellent app that shows you when, you know, you can actually look at your train on the app so that you know when it's going to pull into the station.
Oh, you can actually see the train on the, you can see the train on the app.
You can see the train on the app, and you can also see how crowded the train is so that you know where to stand on the platform to get onto the train if you want a seat. That was an innovation that we launched during COVID because people were a little bit nervous about being packed into cars because of, you know, obvious reasons. So this allowed people to be able to space out on the platform and know exactly how crowded an individual train car was. So all of these little pieces, I think, and people are way more connected now than they ever were, and people are very reliant on their smartphones, and they want to be able to have that kind of information accessible to them. They have that expectation. We also have mobile ticketing, so people can buy tickets on their phone. So having that kind of a connected experience that complements the reliability of the service, I think, gives people an overall positive customer experience that we feel is attracting more and more people back to our system, and we're really happy to see that.
We're talking to women very much at the front of big transport systems, President Catherine Rinaldi of the MTA Metro North Railroad in the United States, and Carly Gorham, who's a senior manager with Smart Transport at NEC. If you've got questions, 1-300-800-222 is the number, 1-300-800-222. You're listening to Philip Clark. This is Nightlife on ABC Radio. Kylie, one of the other things I assume that people would say if they were asked about a public transport system is, why do I have to buy a ticket at all? Why can't I just get on it?
It's certainly a question that some people do ask, and there are certainly transit networks around the world who either have already or are considering choosing to go what we call fare-free with respect to their operation. It really does depend upon the environment in which that transit system is operating. What's the funding model? What's the demand for that service? And does that value proposition stack up? At the end of the day, yes, we all feel that public transportation is a public service.
It's a public good, isn't it? I mean, you might say, well, what's the point of charging people fares for it if you can simply do it through the tax system? I mean, if there's a transport system, public transport system there, people should just be able to get on and use it. What's the whole palaver of ticketing and turnstiles and all of this adds a great layer of expense and complication to the system. Why do it?
Well, you made a very interesting statement. You said if we can do it easily through the taxation system, then we should do it. And I think that that's the crux of the problem. I'm not sure that it is easy to do through the taxation system. But at the end of the day, really the responsibility lies with government to promote policies and implement them that benefit everyone. And if this was one that sat at the front of their decision-making where they felt that it was beneficial, I'm sure we'd see it come up on the agenda. And that's really where we look as an organisation to take the lead from those policy decisions when they're made and see how we can support those outcomes. Mm.
What do you think, Catherine? Would it be better for you if people didn't have to buy a ticket?
So I completely agree with what Kylie just said. It really does become a governmental policy choice with respect to how transportation is funded, because I absolutely agree with the statement you made a little while ago that it is a public service.
Yeah.
The way that it's funded here, it's part of it is through the fare box and the rest of it is, sort of this different fees and taxes
that
the MTA gets a portion of. Could you change that mix up? Sure, of course. But as we were discussing a little while ago, the rail systems like mine are very expensive to run. They require, the upfront operating expenses are considerable and then the capital costs are also considerable. So somebody's got to pay for that. And I think it's ultimately up to the policymakers as to how they want to allocate that burden, right? But it's expensive. Running a public transportation system because of the ongoing maintenance and capital needs is just expensive.
Morgan's in Tasmania. G'day, Morgan.
G'day, Phil. And sorry, what was the name of your guest?
We're Catherine Rinaldi and Kylie Gorham are our guests.
Oh, good to... thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You were just talking about public transportation and all that. I'm in Tassie, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And... obviously, we've got. I'm a young person. I'm 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, we've got the new AFL team coming in a few years, and they want to build that new, flash new stadium in Hobart.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that gets me is, obviously it's a great thing for the state, and, it's very exciting, but how we've got one of the worst public transport systems in the country. We've got Metro Bus, which is very, very outdated and unreliable. And not everyone, obviously I'm lucky enough to drive, but not everyone can drive for various reasons. And also, how are people going to get to and from the games and things like that, because not everyone can, drive a car, and imagine the traffic in the city. It's just going to be off the show.
Yeah, no, it's a point. It's a point, Morgan. It's a point generally, I suppose, isn't it, Kylie, about choices you make in infrastructure, what you're going to spend money on. But you have to spend money on public transport, otherwise cities and communities and regional towns and connections just don't happen.
That's true, Philip. And I think that the example that Morgan's given is a really good one. I hail from Perth and we have Optus Stadium here for all of our AFL games. Mm. It's not a new stadium. It's a few years old now, but it isn't that long since it was built. And one of the decisions that the state government of Western Australia made was to limit the amount of parking that was available at the stadium and to really ensure that it was interconnected into our public transportation system here. So the types of concerns that Morgan has are very real, and they're the sorts of things that are best handled at a local level with the people in that city advocating for the things that they need and looking to examples where things have worked well, like it has here in Perth, as a way to recommend to their government that they should go.
Mm. Catherine, is the system, as you say, you say your lines are pretty much at capacity, maxed out. You can't really build new ones given the given the easements and infrastructure costs of, you know, finding anywhere to build a new line. So is this it in a sense, or is there technology that might make it possible to increase patronage or positions or passengers on the line?
So actually, I'm happy for this question because there is a capital project underway now that will add a new service to my network. And it's what we call the Penn Access Project. So there's an existing Amtrak right-of-way that the trains from Boston to New York take that goes through the Bronx, which is part of my service territory. And we're actually going to be leveraging that Amtrak right-of-way to be able to construct new tracks and four new stations that will allow for there to be service from my New Haven line, which is the line that goes goes out to the state of Connecticut, from the New Haven line into Penn Station, which is the other station, the other major rail station within the city of New York. So this opens up a second terminal for me and also provides commuter rail service to an underserved portion of the Bronx, which is one of the northern boroughs of New York City. So we're really excited about the project because it brings commuter rail to an underserved transit area, but also leverages an existing transportation asset. So it's not, you know, we don't have to condemn property. We're working collaboratively with Amtrak to be able to construct this project. And it's, you know, certainly in the time that I've been here, the first rail expansion project in the Metro North network. So we're really excited about it. It's going to be a it's going to be a great addition for our customers and really open up a new market for us, which is always exciting for
It is exciting. But is in a sense, though, there is a limit to what more can be done.
Certainly. I mean, I think in a major metropolitan area, to your point, I mean, if you have to condemn to be able to expand, that's obviously very challenging. And I think it also goes back to what you were saying at the top of the program, which is that tension between the investments that you need to make to keep up the infrastructure that you have and then whatever it would cost to build new infrastructure, right? I mean, if we had, you know, unlimited dollars to be able to expand and to invest in the existing infrastructure, I'd be a very happy woman, but we don't. We need to figure out how to make use of the capital dollars that we have to keep the existing system safe, as well as think of what new expansion possibilities would make sense to be able to strengthen and grow our market.
What do you think, Kylie? What do you think is the new technology that might make a difference to things?
I think that one of the things that is impacting on our utilization of public transportation, the increasing use of public transportation, there's two trends, and they're each leading into one another. One of the trends, particularly noting around the world, but certainly in Australia, it's been noted that younger people aren't choosing to drive. They're not getting their driver's license. They're not purchasing
their own private vehicle. It's been a trend, isn't it?
It's certainly been a trend, and it's driven by a few factors. First and foremost, it's not necessarily that they're choosing not to drive. It's that they don't really feel that they have the option to. Cost of living pressures. The fact that they stay living at home for longer means that they're sharing a family pool of vehicles are reasons why they don't feel a great need to go out and get a car. And certainly during COVID, we've had a whole cohort of youngsters who missed the opportunity to learn to drive and to pass their test and so on. And what's happened as a consequence of that is that they're choosing other forms of mobility. So they're choosing e-scooters and they're choosing their bicycle and connecting their bicycle with a bus or train service for their overall journey rather than looking to drive all the way themselves. And one of that in itself is one trend. And then on the other side of this, you have this increasing accessibility to public transportation through the availability of information that's encouraging them to continue down that path of choosing mobility other than private vehicles. So really we have this trend emerging, and what we need to do is work out what that overall policy direction is that we need to take so that we can continue to encourage that in a positive way. And look to make public transportation the first choice.
Running big rail transport networks. I don't, but Catherine Rinaldi does. She's president of the MTA and Metro North Railroad in the USA. Railroads, as they call them. We call them railways here. I've no idea. Why is that? Catherine just grew up that way, did it, I guess?
I don't know. That's a good question.
No, it's a good question. Let's not try and answer it right now. What's the new tech, from your point of view, Catherine? Because in a sense, the technology we're talking about has remained sort of unchanged since the tracks were put down, isn't it? Are you still using diesel trains, for example?
We are. Not many. Most of my network is electrified, but yeah. I do have portions that are still diesel.
Hmm. What do you think the new technology is going to be? I mean, clearly there's going to have to be some solution found to diesel trains, isn't it? What do you think it's likely to be, just full electrification?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting question, and that's something that we're looking at very closely. Batteries and hydrogen, and some of these alternate fueling solutions for rolling stock. There's that work is starting here in the U.S., and it's something that we're keeping an eye on. Because I agree with you, I think that there's the diesel locomotives now are way cleaner than the old diesel trains were, but I do think that there's going to be continued pressure for us to look at other cleaner burning alternatives. So we are certainly looking at that. And the industry is evolving very, very quickly, in those areas. So we're following that very, very closely.
Yeah. When I talk about new technology, it has to be acknowledged, doesn't it, that we haven't as humans really found this is it's almost the best way to move large amounts of people quickly. Isn't it? A rail line. Even when we talk about super duper improvements, fast rail or different forms of levitated rail, for example, we're still talking about putting down a track and putting a box on it and moving people that way. It's still the same, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's very efficient, right? I mean, if one of my rail cars holds 100 people, I have an 8-car train, that's 800 people that you're transporting at a time. That's, a bus can't do that. No. A car certainly can't do that. So it is an awfully efficient way to get around, and I agree with Kylie as well with respect to sort of this generational shift. We're certainly seeing the same trends here in the U.S. Absolutely, young people are not driving; they're living at home longer. They really are looking more and more to public transportation because it's convenient, but also because of the environmentally friendly aspects of it. Right? I mean, I think that. We've started to tell that story, and I think that younger people are really responding to that, and they are gravitating more to public transportation. And I think, we need, as Kylie indicated, to figure out what it is, how can we get them there? So we're also looking at, what we call first mile, last mile connectivity to be able to get people to the stations. And also once they're on board, not just giving them a safe and reliable trip, but also an excellent customer experience. What are those expectations with respect to what that customer experience looks like?
How do you do that, Kylie? Because one of the other things, if you ask people about public transport, is they would say, I want it to be safe. Particularly if I'm a woman, for example, traveling home because I've been working late in the office, I want it to be safe, and I want it to be clean. I want to be able to sit on a seat and in a carriage that isn't full of rubbish and graffiti, for example.
Yes, certainly those are very real concerns. And from my own experience, I've travelled around the world and travelled on transportation systems around the world wherever I go. I will say in Australia, we're really very lucky. The services that are provided by our transit agencies really are very, very much world class. But those experiences do happen, and people do have those anxieties about public transportation. I think that we need to keep in mind that there's a whole range of technologies that are happening. We talk about smart transport. Most people see it just at a very surface level with the interaction that they personally have with their public transportation system, the way they pay or the way they find out information. There's a whole range of other things going on that makes public transportation safer that people just aren't aware of. For example, we use a lot of camera imaging, and we can use AI to interpret camera imagery in order to create safety in the operation of public transportation systems. So that can be at a very singular level with a bus where we're using cameras to observe driver behaviour and recognise driver fatigue or distraction and to be able to manage that in real time by alerting the driver to their behaviour and keeping them on task and keeping that whole busload of people safe. But also too, in an environment where people are moving around, you know, AI technology is able to, in near real time, interpret subtle changes in people's movements and actions, their expressions on their face, and anticipate antisocial behaviour. And in doing so, it can perhaps be completely avoided by an interruption to whatever it is that's triggering that behaviour, or at least have a really early response in order to being there to provide some sort of protection to people in that environment. Those sorts of things are happening around us without us necessarily knowing about them. And unfortunately, maybe we need people to know about them a little bit more because it will engender a greater confidence in personal security and safety when they're using public transportation infrastructure.
Sure. Catherine, is there merit in, I mean, you tell me about your own experience in trying to keep trains clean in particular. I mean, there is a theory that if you clean trains a lot and keep them clean, they're easier to, I mean, people are less likely to mess them up. Is that right? Do you think?
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally, you hear that. And I actually, in my own experience, I would agree with that. I mean, I think that, you know, we have personnel who, you know, clean our stations, clean our trains. And but it sort of encourages our customers to clean up after themselves as well.
If the place is clean when you get into the carriage, you're less likely maybe to make a mess. Yeah.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think I think there are certain expectations with respect to how the train car is going to look. And I think people, you know, will buy into that and accept that and do their part in terms of trying to keep the train clean. So I actually completely agree with that. I think if you're able to maintain through your own employees a clean environment, the customers will appreciate that and will do their part with respect to keeping the environment clean as well.
Mm. Catherine, just finally, do you think the great age of rail building is over, that we're going to be trying to improve and maximise what we've got, but we're not going to be building big new rail systems anymore?
You know, I don't know that I agree with that, at least not in the US, right? I mean, there's been new funding available over the course of the last few years through the federal government for rail, unprecedented investments in rail throughout the country. So there are rail projects underway on, you know, in the West Coast and Texas. There's a lot of improvement here along the Northeast Corridor. So I'm not sure that I agree, at least in the U.S., that it's behind us. I think in my own network, in the MTA network, I have already told you about the Penn Access project. There's another project underway to create a light rail line in Queens. It's sort of an underutilized freight line, as well as extend the Second Avenue subway. So I think people recognize the capital dollars are not infinite. So we need to make smart investments to grow the network. But I don't know that I agree that the age of expansion is over. And I'm kind of happy to be part of that new era.
All right.
Because, you know, it really does reinforce the importance of rail service to driving the overall, you know, national economy.
All right, we better wind it up because we've run out of time. But President Catherine Rinaldi has been our guest from the Metro North Railroad, and Kylie Gorham from NEC. And they're both featuring episodes of Women Who Move Nations, a fortnightly podcast series, which is fun too. So to both of you, thank you. Thanks for joining us. And it's been a pleasure talking to you about railroads in your case and railways in our case. Catherine, thanks for your time.
No, thank you.
Thank you. And Kylie, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.